This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to Screen Talk with me, Dan Clark. In case you suddenly wondered or forgot what my voice sounds like, yes, it's me, Dan Clark, back. Thanks for tuning in. Today we have a wonderful show today with a plethora of guests, beginning with the letter J, which was arranged. So we have James with us, James Gill. He's sitting there checking his phone. He will be giving us the film news in a few minutes. And we have Jason Hazley and Joel Morris, two excellent comedy writers, who will be with us in 20 minutes with probably one of the most obscure, bizarre, guilty pleasures we've ever had on the show, which I'm very much looking forward to. I currently have makeup on my nose. I woke up with a massive spot on my face, and just as I was leaving the flat, for some reason my girlfriend went, "Oh, you can't go and do the show with that." I'm like, I don't think they're going to hear my spot.
I can't see your spot.
Can't you? Well, there you go. It worked. She was obviously thinking more of my guests than in the studio. Well,
you're
than
beautiful.
The people.
You, by the way, your tan has gone down significantly from last week.
Okay, great. So
less Des O'Connor, more Tom O'Connor this week.
God, you're an encyclopedia of 70s comics,
yeah,
aren't you?
That's all I've got.
You shouldn't idolise too many of those, because one of them will let you down when U-Tree reveals them.
Oh, man.
Tom O'Connor, what was the show he did?
It was Crosswits, and his catchphrase was, never a crossword. Oh. Kate Copstick was one of the team captains. And the other team captain was... Right, the other team captain was so not famous that one week Tom O'Connor said to him, "What have you been up to?" And he said, "Oh, staying out of trouble." And I was at university watching that thinking, you have literally no work on whatsoever, well, other than Crosswits.
You do realise now in hindsight what he meant by that, don't you?
Yeah,
yeah.
It would appear
it was
so.
Like, you know,
the penny has dropped, hiding in plain sight. I am literally staying out of trouble.
What he meant is, it's so bloody hard not to like have sex with underage people these days.
Oh,
but I'm just trying. I'm trying my best. Slightly strange segue to go from that to this, but before we do talk about the films and bring other guests on, I do want to bring your attention to, because I feel like this is a worthy cause, especially considering what the show is about, to turn your attention to the Curzon Cinema. You know that there is the threat that the cinema is going to be closed. And if you Google 38 degrees, save the Curzon, I urge you to go and sign the petition. I know that 38 degrees website, like once you'd sign one petition, you then get a billion emails saying...
I get so many emails about petitions that I want to start a petition to stop my emails about petitions. Do not... I mean, I nearly named the website I've signed up to, but that would be a bad thing to do.
But if like, they're just emails, you know? It's hardly like...
Yeah.
It's the worst thing, but when it's a good cause...
The Curzon is awesome. I was there the other day to watch a European... modern fairy tale called Tale of Tales, and the Curzon is just an awesome place to see a film.
It's awesome, and it's you know, the threat is that they're going to build another Crossrail, but my thing is, if you're knocking down
every cloud,
but what's the point in that? You know, you say it just means that people in like Ilford or St Albans can get into the centre of town in like 20 minutes to go to a Starbucks or a Top Shop that's sort of maybe just a tiny bit bigger than the
one they're
listening
that's in right now. They're going, sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
No, the I shouldn't say that. The Curzon is a beautiful place.
It is, and I've seen a lot of brilliant stuff. I actually saw, I think it was last year, the Parallax View. Have you seen that?
No.
Film? Oh, amazing.
That's
film.
A classic. It's another classic I've not seen.
It is another classic.
The list is growing.
And it was introduced by Alex Cox.
Oh my God, dude.
It was a really cool event, but they kept showing off about, oh, it's original 35mm copy here, and everyone was really excited about it, and it looked like a fucking piece of shit. It had hairs in it. It had cracks. There were frames missing.
People
so it was
booing.
Just jump. But people were like, oh, this is real cinema.
This is
I'm
how
like,
it should be seen.
Look, I'm all in favour of celluloid and original projection, but not if the original film hasn't been looked after. James, tell us a bit about what's been happening in the film world. You've actually seen a couple of films this week, right? A couple of newbies.
Yes, and I think I can talk. I think I can talk about them both. So I saw Captain America: Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, it is amazing. Honestly, it is so good. There's an airport battle about three quarters of the way through, which has Team Cap versus Team Iron Man. and oh my god, you will be drooling into your popcorn.
Well, as you know, I'm not like the biggest comic book fan.
It's joyous. Sort of, the director.
But I have read people saying that it's the best Marvel movie.
Yeah, some people say it's the best Marvel movie. The men of the match are the directors, the Russo brothers, who broke through on Community, the awesome sitcom, and they've directed it. And how they juggle so many superstars and give them enough screen time. Scream time in the case of some of them is incredible. The action is amazing. The story, also another important
thing.
There's
a story?
Well, wait for it. Another important thing is they're not laying groundwork for spin-offs and future installments like some other superhero movies. They just let the story crack on, and it is all the better for it. You will not be disappointed.
Did they also write it as well?
I don't know.
The film expert, yeah. James Gill, will be with us next week.
Oh, I've done it again. Yes.
Hey, it's all right. You didn't know I was going to ask you about that, to be
but
fair.
But it's really, really good. And then I have seen Everybody Wants Some, which is the new Linklater movie, which I'm going to say, near the end of April, that is the best film I've seen this year. It's knocking Midnight Special into second place.
That is...
Everybody Wants Some.
I mean, it is only April, but...
joyous.
That I'm really excited about
it. The credits roll, mark my words, dude meisters, when the credits roll, you will miss those characters. That is how much fun that film is. There's no complex plot. You are just following a bunch of dudes around for 3 days, and it is wonderful.
I do that anyway.
Yeah, yes. Well, you're going to think it's a documentary. Often in a screening room in a comedy, I am the only person laughing because, you know, some journalists...
In the press screening.
In the press screening, I embarrass myself by how much I laugh. Last night, the whole room was rocking. Everyone loved it. There was a small platoon who went from shortlist, and we nearly hugged it out at the end. That was how much
we loved
amazing.
It. That's amazing. I was listening to an interview with Linklater, and they said that at a press screening in America, it got a standing ovation.
Wow.
But
they
said
we let
everyone
him down last night.
But that was a room full of men in their sort of 45 plus.
It's
think
fantastic.
It speaks to that age, is that, would you say?
No, because it will remind anyone of
being young.
Yeah, and how awesome, university or college was. It's just, it's fantastic.
What I love about Linklater is, like, he does his kind of indie films that have, you know, have that kind of naturalistic, sometimes, you know, I don't want to say meandering, but kind of more...
Yeah, no, absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
More sort of, like, mood films.
Yeah.
But then he can go and do something like School of Rock.
School of Rock, which is
like
awesome.
Is the perfect sort of family comedy.
Beautiful movie. I nearly rolled a tear at the ending, as they come out on stage and, oh, my God.
Yeah, I love that bit.
And that's, you know, Teacher's Pet. I love all... It's just... The soundtrack to that movie is... I mean, music's important to Linklater, but... I mean, Boyhood, how that didn't win Best Picture.
I was, I think, only because I watched it so late after it had come out.
We talked Boyhood.
No,
before,
we haven't talked about Boyhood.
So my wife and I will go to the cinema a lot, and as the credits roll, I will turn to my wife, and she will give me like a marks out of 10 using her fingers. So
with
usually,
one hand.
Usually she's like, so five fingers and a thumb, 6 out of 10, sometimes 5 out of 10. And then Boyhood, the credits rolled, I turned to her, there were tears streaming down her face, and she just defiantly...
I'd love it if she was
crying.
2 fives,
10 out of 10.
And she gave it 1.
No, all 10. All 10.
Yeah, I guess the hype slightly ruined it for me. That was the problem.
That's the danger of seeing a film too late, isn't it?
Yeah, well, or you wait so long that you've sort of forgotten the hype. But I just kind of wish I'd known nothing about it, so that when you started to go, holy shit, that's the same actor growing up
incredible.
In the film.
Yeah.
That realization as you watch it would have been amazing, rather than knowing so much about the process of it before the film actually came out.
Do you not think Ethan? Do you not wish Ethan Hawke was your dad in that movie?
It's probably quite cocky of me to say this, but people often say
that you're like Ethan Hawke.
Yeah, not like him, but you know.
No, I don't know. Go on. No, please.
In the past, they said I look a bit like him. But anyway, listen. I don't know
really?
Why you and I often talk about our lookalikes. Any film news? Anything exciting?
Breaking news. Someone has told you that you look like Ethan Hawke.
That's film news.
That's the biggest bombshell I've ever heard.
I'm a bit offended by that.
Well. Just think about it. The new trailer for Magnificent Seven remake is out now. I know some people are anti-remakes, and I love Steve McQueen as much, if not more, than anyone, but I do think that Magnificent Seven is a movie that could use a remake, because that original, I know it's a classic, but you could lop an hour out of that movie easily.
Mm-hmm.
So I am all for a remake with Ethan Hawke. Callback.
There you go.
Ethan Hawke, Denzel Washington, Chris Pratt. Bring it on.
It was weird watching Chris Pratt in a movie where he clearly wasn't the lead. Suddenly, because he's obviously been the lead.
So he must have filmed that a while ago, maybe.
I don't know if it's that, but it's just his sudden emergence has just been that he is the lead in his movies, and his films have been absolute gigantic
mega
hits.
Smashes.
And then suddenly he's like playing, not in a, like, I don't mean that,
I know
as
what
in,
you mean. No, I know what you
but
mean.
But just like, oh right, okay, yeah, he's.
I wonder if they'll all try upstage Denzel, like the original Mag 7 all tried to upstage Yul Brynner.
I don't think you're allowed to upstage Denzel.
No one can upstage Denzel.
No, I think it's not allowed.
I think Chris Pratt would be very cool with supporting Denzel, but in the original, there's a great documentary that goes with it, but McQueen was trying every trick in the book, so whenever Yul Brynner speaks, the rest of the Magnificent Seven are all doing things to try and get the attention. So McQueen, for no reason, takes off his cowboy hat, tests the wind, and then another scene, loads the bullets in his gun, and then another scene, apparently they built a little mound for Yul Brynner to stand on, because he wasn't the tallest dude, as with most actors, and I think it's McQueen, as the scene plays out, kicks the mound away so that Yul Brynner gets progressively smaller and smaller. Awesome.
Oh, there you go. Any actors listening? Oh, sorry, go on.
The final bit of news is shortlist. I can say this with my shortlist hat on. Shortlist, I've just broken the exclusive, that Robert Downey Jr. has revealed that Sherlock 3 will start rolling this year. Yes.
Interesting. That was going back to a friend of mine we were talking about last week. Drew Pearce was attached to write that at one point, but I don't think he is anymore.
Go on.
Well, that's it. It's not really an exclusive, is it?
I'm still pretty chuffed that Drew Pearce is your mate.
Funnily enough, there's a link there with our guests today as well. So, bit of TV talk. Have you watched the People versus O.J. Simpson?
No, I'm like the only person in Britain who's not watching it.
Well, so people have been saying to me, "Oh, it's really good. It's really good." I'd read some reviews.
The final episode is supposed to be outstanding, isn't it?
So I watched the first episode, and I'm only saying this because I wouldn't just say this about stuff. I'm saying it because my opinion changed. But to begin with, I watched the first episode. I thought this isn't just like I'm not into it. This is shit. This is like naff. It's overblown.
They can put it on the poster.
Yeah. And then
this is shit.
And I didn't watch
Ethan
it.
Hawke's
I didn't watch it for like I don't know. Another 2 weeks or something, and then the more rave reviews, more. Oh, like, what am I missing? What am I? I'll watch another episode. I'm like, I still don't get this. Like, what is the now? Episode 6, because I'm not in now. I think I was in. That would be a weird to like. I still don't like this, but I'm going to watch the whole series. But episode 3, I think.
Hour 6. Yeah. This is the one. I can feel it.
Last 10 minutes. I will like this fucker. I'm completely hooked, and I don't know what I can't work out. What was the stylistic choice of the way it's shot and the way it's slightly performed? Is that a deliberate choice to replicate the kind of era, the 90s? Because there's a bit of a sort of TV movie
from
feel
what I
to
hear
it.
That's deliberate, and also someone in the office has said that someone associated with the case has come out and said that they've got it eerily spot on.
Really?
Yeah, because I was expecting them to say it was nothing like that, and someone has said, yeah, that is worryingly on the money how they've done it.
That was exactly how we acted back then.
Yeah, like crazy people.
Yeah, it's been an amazing turnaround. I think there's only ever been like maybe one or two shows where I've had that complete in the history of my life of watching things where I started
sort of turnaround.
Off that complete turnaround. Because now all I'm thinking about today is can't wait to get home tonight and watch those final two episodes.
What were the other shows where you turned around?
In recent years, weirdly, and I'm a bit ashamed to say this because it's become one of my favourite shows of all time, is Mad Men. I watched the first episode, but the difference with that was I knew it was a well-made show. It was beautiful, it was brilliantly performed, well-written, but I just found it boring. And I put it down, and then 6 months later, I was like, because I'd bought the DVD, I thought, I'll give it another go. Three more episodes, and that was it. It became definitely in my top three dramas of all time. Do you like Mad Men?
Never watched it.
Okay, good.
Too busy not watching films.
James, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Dan, God bless you. I love you dearly.
Yeah.
Did you see my tweet the other day where I put I tweeted I heart Dan Clark, included him in the tweet.
No, I didn't.
Nothing.
See that.
Nothing from Dan. Social media felt pretty lonely. Just going to check that. Yeah. No, it's still nothing.
You might want to think about the fact that I don't check Twitter enough before you do things like that. Before you, Dan, where are you? And start quoting Alan Partridge. James, will you come back again?
I mean, always
this is developing into a
double act.
It's a double act.
It.
Yeah. I don't know what kind of dynamic, what we're following. Is it Laurel and Hardy? Is it Little and Large?
It's Cannon and Ball.
Cannon and Ball.
Yeah.
There is a lot of 70s and 80s references today. And there's going to be even more with our next guests. How old are you?
23.
Yeah.
30. It's bad when the producer fucking pisses herself. 37.
37.
How old are you?
39.
God, you look good for 39.
I'm 40. Oil of ole. 40. 40 this year.
You've got smooth skin, my friend.
Yeah.
You're 39.
Yeah. Can you believe that?
Well done.
Thank you.
Well played.
I finally got a compliment from James after that awful Ethan Hawke debacle.
That's going to stay with me.
James, thanks very much.
Take care, pal. Thank you.
See you soon. Now, I'm going to play, before we bring on our guests today, which I'm very excited about, I'm going to play my choice of music today, which is actually a piece of music that I was discussing with Tess Morris from last week. This is an amazing piece of music from Trading Places. It's the opening piece of music by Mozart. It's The Marriage of Figaro. I love this piece of music, not just because I love the music, but it also brings back so many fond memories of my childhood. Not suddenly I've given you the impression that I, as a child, was, you know, sitting around listening to Mozart. That is not the case. But I rewatched Trading Places as a child and a teenager so many times. This is a beautiful piece of music. Luckily, we're... You familiar with that, guys?
Well, Mozart.
Yeah.
The Marriage of Mozart. I love that by Figaro.
Yeah. I love that you went a little bit more Cockney there. What? Mozart?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was trying to get in there. Hey, Dan.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, Dan.
Hey.
Thanks for having us here.
Ladies,
I've never been to a secret underwater base before.
I know, this is amazing. Well, it's just, you know, I've got this weird paranoia that during a podcast, the end of the world might happen.
Yeah.
You know, there may be a nuclear blast. And I just think, as long as me and my guests are safe to continue podcasting in a post-apocalyptic world.
It's the only reason we accepted the invitation is we knew we'd be safe.
It is a weird invitation to get. Listen, guys, just in case the world ends, do you want to come and do a podcast?
Yeah.
We have with us, we're very lucky to have two annoyingly talented men who I've actually known for some years. With us, we have Joel Morris.
Hello.
Hello, there you go. Just to distinguish. You actually sound a little bit similar, don't you?
Do we?
A little bit.
Shall I be Geordie?
Could you do a Geordie? Yeah. A female Geordie?
Just do that. I'll be Sarah Milligan from...
That's pretty good.
Like the Scots.
That is pretty good. And Jason Hazley.
Good evening.
Good evening. Who goes from Cockney to posh audiobook voice in a nanosecond.
Amazingly.
Jason, you know, when I was preparing this, because I know that's hard to believe that I've actually prepared this, but I realised I've known you. Next year, it will have been for 20 years.
Wow.
Isn't that...
Wow.
That is scary, isn't it?
Now I feel about 400 years old.
Yeah. I know.
20 years, man.
Yeah.
Have you brought a cake?
I have. Guess what? So, yeah, we met in 97, I believe. That's how...
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, we did.
You're
there
right,
you go.
Yes.
So this show's just about like reminiscing about the 90s. Seems to be what I've done.
I remember the
almost
90s. They were great,
almost
weren't they?
Every show we've done a little bit of that. Now these guys, they are I'm very very excited to have them on because they, after many many years writing for TV shows, they've written their own books. They have had a bona fide hit with their books, the series of books, Lady Bird Books for Grown-ups. Is that the official title of the series of books?
Yeah.
Because on Amazon it's the Ladybirds for grown-up. Grown-ups.
Yeah. Ladybirds. What I don't like is Ladybird Books for Adults, because that sounds like a very specific niche.
I mean, that I bought that one.
Yeah.
Well, that was a question I was going to ask later in the show, but just quickly, when you did this book, for people that don't know about the book, this is the series of books that were released just before Christmas, where you... Explain the book to the listeners, if for people that haven't come across them.
We went to Ladybird. We were trying to think of... we do comedy books and we do comedy writing for TV, and we thought, what would be a good comedy book to do that could sell and would be in our key that we like doing? We like doing pastiche. We have done The Framley Examiner, which is a pastiche newspaper, and we did Touch of Cloth with Charlie Brooker, which is a pastiche detective show. We like working in sort of parody and pastiche. We did loads of sketches that are pastiches, and we thought, we both love Lady Bird books. We collect them and we had them since we were kids. We'd seen in a bookshop some reproduction Ladybird books for the 60s ones that were in a box, and we thought, oh my god, they've got a factory somewhere that makes Ladybird books, but they don't make Ladybird books anymore. So we just sent an email to Ladybird and said, could we write nonsense and put them in Ladybird, and can you put that in the front of your factory, and out the other end of the factory would come some stupid books. And that's what they are. They're basically they're the...
I love that you also told them how to print and reproduce.
We're very
and,
in control of the means of production. The idea was, because it's impossible to get the artwork anymore, because there are those artists who painted like Lady Bird and Eagle comic don't exist anymore. So we said, why don't we just use the original artwork that you've got in an archive, which it turned out they did have in an archive. They were going to bin it, but they saved it. So we got to play with the original artwork. And we said, we won't change them. We won't paint in iPods and beer cans. We will just use the original artwork from your childhood, and then we'll recaption it as if it's still going on now, as if the people who made Ladybird books when we were in the 60s, 70s, 80s were still making them, but they were making them for the same audience, but the audience were now in their 30s and 40s rather than 8 or 9, which is a neat, sort of a simple idea. But they just immediately said, yeah. It took 5 hours for them to say yes, and here's the keys to the archive. And we published them. We thought we'd sell a few, because Kima books sell, but they never sell that many.
And you sold a few.
Yeah, I think The Husband, which is one of the 8 that we did, is the number one best-selling book of last year, like including
that
Jamie Oliver, which is just...
Including Jamie Oliver, I love that.
It's a bit like, I mean, not J.K. Rowling, it's a bit like J.K. Rowling, where people go, so obviously what you do to have a bestseller is write a book about wizards at a posh school. It's the last thing you do to have a hit book. So the last thing you do to have a hit book is write a children's humour book, or a book that looks like a children's book and is a humour book. They don't really sell.
For adults.
So it's just, it was a complete surprise. So we're happy as Larry.
5 hours response. I bet you couldn't believe that, having worked in television and waited for a response on a script from an executive. You're like, five? Oh. Well, that is literally, I don't know what the math of that, but normally it's 5 months.
No, you know, I'm sure you know who I'm talking about if I say two writers who pitched a sitcom which finally got piloted 11 years after they had pitched it.
I don't know who
11
these
are. Years. I'll tell you afterwards.
We've
been to Penguin's offices and Ladybird's offices, and what they don't have is that desk they have at the BBC where you store scripts for 10 years. The one that's locked. With the lions that guard it, so you can't get in. You have to wait for the lions to die before you can get to the scripts. So the scripts arrive with the postman, they're guarded by lions for 10 years, and then you're allowed to make it. That desk just isn't there in publishing.
I once had a conversation with Bob Larby, who's half of Esmond and Larby, who wrote The Good Life and Ever Decreasing Circles, and I said to him, and what was it like pitching shows then back in the 70s and 80s? And he said, well, I'll give you an example. Me and John had an idea for a show about national service, so we went over to the BBC and we parked outside and went upstairs to Jimmy so-and-so's office and said, do you want a series about national service? And he went, no, I don't think I do. So we got back in John's Mini and we drove over to ITV and we walked in there and said, do you want a series about national service? And they said, yeah. And we wrote 8 series of it. Guess I'm in.
That is beautiful.
But
I mean, what's more alarming about that is that they could drive through central London.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is, I can't believe they could do that so quickly.
Yeah.
That I was having a conversation yesterday with someone saying that, you know, it's so infuriating when you watch these documentaries about porridge or Python, or where they go, you know, and then we took it to the head of comedy or to the controller, and they were like, "Oh, I'm not sure about this. Oh, go on."
Yeah,
and you're like, "What? You had you were 50-50 and you still took a chance." If there's even a 2% doubt nowadays, people are like, "Oh, I just don't think we can do that."
Well, I think it's William Goldman said this about Hollywood. I mean, it's not unique to the BBC or to comedy or anything, but he said that if Hollywood greenlit everything they binned and binned everything they greenlit, it would make exactly the same amount of money, because no one really knows. And it's always the things that are huge hits. People claim they knew they'd be huge hits.
Yeah.
But we were talking to a commissioner a couple of weeks ago who said they had the read for Big Top, was it? The show that is now like a byword for the worst sitcom they ever made. Apparently the read for that was the funniest read anyone had ever been. Everyone was totally confident with it. And I remember talking to a friend who'd interviewed people who made the Bond movies, and they said every time the rushes came down with Timothy Dalton, they all went, "We finally got it. We have got the Bond we should have had first off. This is going to be the best, most successful, most popular Bond movie ever." And they came out and said, and people didn't like him. You never know. In production, you never know.
I like
you
Dalton.
Can't blame him. I'm a huge Dalton fan.
He's, I love Dalton.
He's sort of increased in reputation because he's doing the same performance as Daniel Craig's giving, so it's come back into fashion.
A little bit more thespy than Daniel Craig.
But, I love his fruitiness.
He's still. I like that he's on film, but he's still sort of projecting for the back row. I agree with you. I feel like there is nobody knows anything. That classic William Goldman quote. But there is one man in America, in American TV, who does know something, and that is Chuck Lorre, who created Two and a Half Men, The Big Bang Theory. These aren't shows I'm a fan of, but he's got something like 5 hits. All of the shows he's made. It's like, so there is one person who does know how to make smash hits.
We need to extract his minerals and bottle them.
And put them in someone with taste.
Yeah. Well, someone said that about it. It was about when Pixar had a relentless run. It was hit, and there was an Onion story. So I can say Hollywood says, "Please stop it. You're spoiling it for the rest of us. Yeah, we've said no one knows anything, and you appear to know. Will you just stop making hits?"
That is enough. Yeah, they are. Would you say that their run is?
They're diversifying. They're making more movies. They had I read that great Ed Catmull book on Pixar, and their big new thing is they're making more films for slightly lower budgets. So people are saying, some of these are failing. They're not costing as much to make, so they're taking more risks. So because of that, a few of them aren't going to succeed, which I think is probably good for the studio.
I thought you were going to say they're making more films for slightly lower success.
Lower quality.
For lower quality.
Lasseter went and he actually moved. There was a bar and he actually lowered it.
Yeah, he went in and did that David Schwimmer thing where he just said lower. So going back to the books, I'm quite fascinated that's how it came about, because you have a relationship with Penguin already. They've published your books before, right?
I think that's why they answered the email. I mean, we did Family Examiner, we did for them in 2001, 2002.
Oh my God.
So basically, so we had a long term. And obviously, we bring them ideas all the time, and some of them go and some of them don't, and we've ghostwritten books for them and things, so they know that we're a safe pair of hands.
Yeah, but I thought that you, being that you know your stuff, you know your beans, that you work with these people, that you would have had the idea sort of in-house rather than be in a shop and go, "Oh, look, they still make these."
Yeah, like all good ideas, it just turned up out of the blue.
And also, this is the thing. I think I mentioned this to you when I saw you last. That, you know, I equally respect people that are tenacious and go, "I'm going to go out and make money or make something a success." But when you make something that, because I always get the impression with you guys that you're really ultimately your goal is just to make something that makes you laugh and your friends laugh, and that's just a fun thing. But
that's sort of all you can do, isn't it? Really, if you're writing comedy, especially when there's two of you, you've got to try and make the other one laugh.
Also, I think you've got to find within the thing you're doing. We're not hacks, but we're busy. We're very, very busy comedy writers. We write for anyone, and we can do house style. We can sit there for a couple of days learning how someone writes. And we wrote with, we did some work with Brendan O'Carroll, who wrote Mrs. Brown's Boys.
Yeah.
Now, I really like Mrs. Brown's Boys. It's really well done. I know lots of other writers don't. I can see why it's working, but it's not our style. And I wouldn't I'm a sort of brass eye day to day.
This will be an exclusive. Morris likes Mrs. Brown's Boys.
Good. I can see how it works. But the great thing with that is we did the tie-in books for it. To write them, we had to find where our sense of humour intersected with Mrs. Brown's, and it was in the autobiography of us observing our mums and our nans, And you've often said that those two Mrs. Brown's Boys books we wrote are the most autobiographical books you've ever written about
our
family.
Are you serious?
They're full of stories about our families. And so we ended up just writing a load of like tall tales about our mums. And at the end of it, we laughed our socks off doing it. It was brilliant fun.
Oh, wow. And were you ghostwriters on that, or did you get...
Brendan gave us credit. We got a little thanks brilliant. In front, and our names are on it. So it's he's quite open about it.
There no point at all when the offer came in, or the possibility of doing this, where you thought, but how does our humour fit in with this? Or were you just like,
no, because we quite
give
like
us the money.
We quite like a challenge. You know, yeah. We're good at... One of the reasons we do pastiche is that we're good at observing other people's style and then copying it.
Right.
Which is what... which is what the Mrs. Brown's gig was. It was we sat there and watched all 21 episodes of it and just filled ourselves up with brown until we were as brown as we could.
You've
possibly
got on heroin.
Browned up.
Yeah.
But it's the same as the Gibbons brothers do for Alan Partridge. Yeah. But I think that people sort of think that in order to do that, you have to sort of go, well, this is something I've always known. Yeah, no, you can sit and learn it. They would have sat and watched loads of Alan Partridge to learn how Alan Partridge... works, so they can now work with Armando and write Alan Partridge.
There is something quite freeing about that as well, because I've only ever done it once where I've written for somebody else, and I wasn't sure I could do it because the show was about three northern girls in their 20s.
But like, in many ways three northern girls in their
20s. I know, but I didn't know that at the time. Everyone else obviously could see that in me.
I
didn't know that. And I thought, how do I write that? But actually, once you... There's something freeing about it not being your creation in terms of, like, you know, well, there's something less putting your heart, you know, on your sleeve about it, so you can try stuff, and if people say, oh, that isn't working, you don't feel quite as sensitive in a way. Do you know what I mean?
I mean,
when it's your thing and then you get some negative feedback, you're like, no, but this is, I'm writing about me. Yeah. How dare you?
But
like,
you've got a background in stand-up and things, which we don't do stand-up, but we write character, and the point is I'm not any of those characters when we write a character. I'm not. So you're always writing through someone else's voice. Shakespeare wasn't a Prince of Denmark, but he was quite able to write one.
Yeah.
Is that feeling, that's that part of the craft, isn't it?
How did he do that? How did he do so
dressed,
many?
He dressed up as one. Because there were eight of him.
Oh, yeah. What I was going to say was the wonderful thing about that book is it felt to me like you guys had written it, and maybe you had an inkling that it could do well, but it did really well. Really well. And it wasn't sort of premeditated. It wasn't like a calculative sort of cynical attempt at just making... You wrote something that you just thought would be really funny, and then it became a hit. And to me, that's the most joyous thing, when people just do what they do well and then it becomes successful.
It was very word of mouth. We got a lovely thing. People started saying, well, I can see why they're big success. What with Penguin's big marketing might? When we had to go in and persuade Waterstones to stock them. They didn't want them originally.
Are you serious?
Seriously.
It was a real fight. We weren't in supermarkets. The usual way we've done books before, you sell them through supermarkets. I think we were in supermarkets about 2 or 3 weeks before Christmas, because they'd all gone, oh, it's a bit of a risk, this retro thing. People had to be persuaded to love it. So there was no sense that anyone at Penguin had gone, well, we'll just march in there and pile these up on tables. Very often, the humour tables are really busy at Christmas, and to ask to reserve a space to put 8 books out, it's quite a big gap.
Someone was asking me the other day about the publicity and saying, well, you must have done loads of publicity. And I think we did two interviews, something like that.
We did one interview on Loose Ends, and it was cancelled because of the Paris attacks. And you were everywhere. No, we weren't. We were cancelled.
Good Morning Britain rang us and said, we're going to do a piece on the books. Could you come down to the studios tomorrow morning? We said, yeah, no problem. Then at 5 in the afternoon, they rang us and said, it's all right, we don't need you. we filmed some kids reading the books to their parents. We don't need you.
It was the easiest publicity campaign since Gorillaz. We just didn't have to be there.
Oh, that's amazing. So did you? But you've done loads of retrospectively, haven't you? Since it's been a success, no?
No,
I keep seeing pictures of you guys. No. You know, it's opening.
It's been very
superstores.
It's been very quiet.
Have we been opening superstores?
Cutting ribbons.
People are pretending to be us because no one knows what we look like.
Oh, that's good. Was there any boundaries? Did they set any boundaries about what you can and can't? Were they protective over their brand?
We really thought they would be. In fact, they weren't. We were.
Yeah.
We
really?
Decided, yeah, we would impose. Because we had the first one we tried was the hipster, which was just a nice... you can write anything about hipsters because they're deeply silly and loads of fun.
Yeah.
But we thought we just need to get the sort of house style right, get the voice right, make it sound like a Ladybird book. While we were trying some things out, we were trying to find an example of something which was needlessly expensive. And I thought, and we found a picture of some cupcakes. So we put the we write them to the page, right? So mm-hmm. we're designing them as we write them. We put the cupcakes up there, and we wrote on the left-hand page, "Well, these cupcakes can fuck off." But and we looked at it and thought it's very funny, but it's just not Ladybird.
Really,
it's we've also got to pull, we have to pull all that out. We've got to write it. Yeah, it's got to sound like a kid's book for the pastiche to be authentic.
We've got we are Ladybird authors. It's got the Ladybird logo on the front. And the idea is they also they can be mistaken for kids' books. So you the idea was that kids might pick them up. So we couldn't write in the we write
so
for
you
Viz.
Can swear and you
could we write for Viz, but we couldn't do it in the Viz tone. Even though it's slightly a Vizzy idea about observation and being a bit frank about stuff. But the other thing is, there have been Ladybird pastiches for, since Ladybird came out, with the earliest one we found dates back to the early 60s.
1959.
So basically, people have been doing it, and the usual joke, which you see on the internet when it's done, is that people put a Ladybird image up and they do a caption like, "Your fucking car's fucked." And we went, okay, so that's been done, the basic juxtaposition gag, which obviously, as comedy writers, you know, you go, okay, it's Zippy, and Zippy's on drugs.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, I've done that. So we said, what happens if we don't do that? If we don't do things that aren't suitable for children, what if we use a voice that is completely suitable for children to explain mortgage anxiety or something? And it seemed to me there was a funnier sweet spot there, and one that hadn't really been mined. You couldn't get that for free by clicking onto a link on the internet.
Do you think that's part of its success? Do you think maybe
my mum likes it because it's not rude?
Yeah. And do you think kids are really into it as well?
I showed it to my 10-year-old daughter. Had a look at the Ladybird Book of the Midlife Crisis, and she said, "Daddy, I don't really understand this." And I said, "Good, that's correct. You've got a while before you understand
God,
this."
Can you imagine if she did?
Yeah.
"Daddy, this really speaks to me."
You've like, got the soul of a 43-year-old. You're about to have Richard Hammond's soul. He died in that crash and it passed into my child.
Well, in between the books that you did in the early noughties, do I remember rightly, one of you told me this, that when you were either teens, because you guys have known each other since school, right?
Yeah.
What age?
We met 17? In 6th form. Yeah,
17, right. So back in like the early 50s, so you guys knew each other when you were teenagers. Did you tell me a story that you entered a competition or you submitted a sketch to Russ Abbott?
Yeah, we got Russ Abbott paid us 15...
It wasn't a competition, it was a professional writing gig.
Okay, sorry.
Russ Abbott paid us 15 quid for a quickie.
Oh my God.
That's a dirty thing to say, isn't it?
Yeah.
How'd you like that?
I love that. You're in Mrs. Brown's Boys territory.
It wasn't just Russ, it was Russ and Bella. Bella and full set.
Did they put a super injunction on this?
The threesome.
Yeah. It wasn't even, none of it was our words either, was it? Because it was the three witches from Macbeth round the cauldron, and one of them says, "When shall we three meet again?" Another one goes, don't know when. Mm. But I know. So
we hadn't written any of the words.
Not even our words,
We just cut them up from something, like we did with the Ladybird books. We cut them up and stuck them together. But we got for that, and that was, and then we did a lot of work for bits of work for Russ. We did some books for him actually.
How old were you then?
Would have been about 19, 18.
Wow. 19. And then, because I was thinking, did you go right? We could obviously you were interested in comedy writing, and you could have embarked on a career there and then. You know, you were so young that by the time you were 25, you would have been, you know, writing, doing what you're doing now. But did you guys go, look, we can be TV comedy writers at any age, but we can't be pop stars at any age. Let's go and do this music thing. Because what some people may or may not know is that you both were in successful bands.
No, we were both in bands.
That was very modest of you.
We were both successfully in bands.
if your yardstick is Coldplay, then yes, you were in bands, but you released albums.
Yeah.
You know, and this is
gigs and things.
True. This was pre-social media, internet.
Yeah.
Releasing albums and having fans is
something that people used to do.
Is something people used to do without just, you know, creating a following online or something. But was that a conscious decision? Did you both go, you know, maybe we should?
It definitely wasn't unconscious. I didn't accidentally do it. I don't know why we sort of stopped. I think we couldn't get stuff away, could we? We tried writing for, I think, Weekending or something, one of the Radio 4 open door shows. And we just weren't getting anything away, and I think we were running out of money. So we both went off and did other things. You went and worked in a bookshop. I was working for a sheet music publisher, and that's how we sort of drifted into music from that position of not having
bands on the side
and anything else to do.
And then after about 10 years of that, nearly.
So
nearly
what you're saying is you were like, oh, we can't get any work as a TV writer. What should we do for a day job?
What's the easiest
Let's
thing to do?
Let's be in a band.
Yeah. Well, actually, I think it was oddly, we kept the day jobs for a bit and then went off and did something else you wanted to do that seemed to fit with a day job. And then at the end of it, as the music industry was starting to fragment around the 2000s, and sort of Napster and things were happening, and suddenly the record deals started falling out, the record industry started panicking, and we went, well, what do we do next? And we went back to comedy writing because we'd stayed friends and things. But I think there, suddenly there was a the internet that destroyed, oddly, and I just thought about this, the internet that destroyed the music industry created great new openings for comedy, in the sense of you could put a website up like did for the Framley Examiner, which was inspired by me talking to Charlie Brooker, and I said, how the hell did you get TV Go Home away? And he went, it cost £25, buy a domain name, put it up there, make it funnier than everything else, and people will forward it round. You don't have to publish a magazine or get a job in Private Eye or anything.
But this was before you could just log on to a website and get a template for a website.
Yeah, so you had to do
all the codings and
but it was a little bit of a crash course in sort of how to do it, but it wasn't as hard as, I don't know, going and touring as a stand-up or something. It was quite an easy way to get a big audience very, very quickly. And when we did the Framley Examiner, we put that up, spoof local newspaper, we put it up, and within a day, we'd had it emailed back to us by friends saying, have you seen this? We put it up anonymously without our names on. We went, oh, that's ours. And then within 2 weeks, we had a book deal off it. So it was the sense of you could hit a big stage very quickly.
I've really got to get into the book business here. Because
they're lovely.
They get back to you quickly, don't they? That's actually reply to emails.
We didn't even email them. They just sent an email saying, we think this
is
really funny.
You didn't even email them?
No, we didn't. No. They found it and said, they have people who scare. Back then, it was an exciting thing. I think because Charlie had just been a big hit, there was the possibility that you would find new comedy on the internet. So I think we, back then it was The Onion, Charlie and us, and the competition wasn't very hot. And we also said most of the comedy back then was people forwarding you a picture of a cat with the word shit on it. And we said, if we can aim slightly higher than that, then it will be a real revelation for people.
It was a good time. How did you meet Charlie back then to get that piece of advice?
I used to work, I was at college with a guy called David McCandless, who's now an information graphics guy, who does The Guardian's big infographics, wrote Information is Beautiful. He's a smashing mind and a nice guy. And he was working in computer magazines. And he and I used to edit our college magazine, and he had a day where he couldn't go into his computer magazine, and he said, go in and cover for me. And I went and covered for him, and Charlie was working there. So I bumped into him when Charlie was a computer journalist.
And then how long until you met him again and actually started working together?
We submitted some stuff for TV Go Home, which he used. So that's how we sort of got to know him. Then I then found out he lived quite near me, so I said, let's go and have a drink. So we got to know each other.
But he just knocked on his door.
Yeah, just knocked on his door. Right. And he was living in Battersea, and I was living in Wandsworth, so we could meet roughly, you know, just because both of us take a half mile walk and end up at a pub.
As all the things in comedy, well, we've discussed this at length recently, everything in comedy happens in pubs. It still does. It did in the 60s and it does now. If you go drinking and you're not a bell end, people give you work because they go, oh, I was drinking with that guy last night, maybe he could. Especially if you're a writer, people go, who can I get to work on this
show?
That's
where I've gone wrong.
Be in the pub all the time. And it's great.
I stopped drinking and became a bell end.
Yeah, you can.
Those two crucial mistakes. But I am a bell end.
It's the thing you have to explain to your wife, where are you going tonight? I've got to go, very important work. I've got to be in the Yorkshire Grey all evening.
Only yesterday I texted someone said, are we still meeting at 5? And he went, yeah, I'm just finishing up a meeting in O'Neill's. And I was like, that is, I think maybe it's a very media thing as well, but I thought, wow, that still happens even pre-6pm.
Yeah.
I thought drinking during the day was...
People are more dangerous. It's dangerous. It's a slippery slope. But no, it is like.
But if it gets you work.
But the pub or the virtual pub, you know, it's like the Facebook golf course. For for the comedy world, isn't it? It's where the deals are done.
It's also, and it's to do with being sociable. Getting work is to do with being nice. Any agent will tell you this, that you won't get booked if you're awkward. People have to sort of like you because they've got to spend some time with you, working with you, writing with you. And it's either the pub or Facebook and Twitter and things have been really good. I mean, the number of, especially women I know, who have kept their careers going while they had kids, and this is a huge generalisation, but women who sort of have stayed at home to look after the kids, their careers have kept going in a way that 10 years ago they wouldn't have done, because they're still socialising with all their colleagues on Facebook, especially journalists as well.
It's really sort of being present, isn't it?
Yeah, it's making sure you're visible, so people remember you. And I think that sort of, that sounds very 70s, that the men are down the pub and the women are at home, but stay at home dads as well. But I think what's happened is that you'd have a family and you'd vanish. That doesn't happen anymore. Actually, men and women, I know people who've sort of stayed at home to look after their families or have moved out, they've managed to stay visible thanks to Facebook and things. I think, oddly, for all the damage that it's done to the way people shout at each other, it's been quite nice for making sure that people can get work.
My thing is that I have the compare and despair issue with Facebook so much. And I hate to admit it.
Well, you look at people's lovely lives.
I'm just like, why have they got that? Or why are they so lucky and blessed? And I feel like shit. But you obviously, it's like in the old days, you walk down the street and you see a couple holding hands and kissing and thinking, why is their relationship so perfect?
The Joe Jackson, but is no she one really going that, out with him thing?
Yeah, but then they go home and, you know, beat the hell out of each other, and you have no idea what's really going on.
But one of the strange things about social media is that everyone is an actor. Everyone now has a press agent, which is Facebook, putting out what they need to be see, the press photographs of their beautiful smiling children, and a minute after that the kids are screaming. Everyone's in Hello now.
Yeah. So did you I know that you obviously consciously did everything, but was there a choice where you went, right, let's stop doing the music and genuinely focus on comedy? Or did that, because in my memory you sort of were doing Framley still when you were kind of doing music as well?
Yeah, towards the very end of when Ben and I were working together, and we knocked it on the head because we just,
this is Ben and Jace,
yeah, we couldn't make enough money. I think we made, the last year we were working together, I think we made 13 grand in a year, which is just, you know,
that's good.
That was 200 years ago, but it wasn't much money.
No.
Once they offered us this book deal, said, do you want to do this book deal, we thought we'd give it a plunge. And then I think I was on tour with Beth Gibbons for a while as well. She did quite a big
Porter's
world
Head
tour.
Beth, yeah.
And so that was a sort of little financial help. But then at some point, I think we just decided to take the plunge, didn't we? We thought, let's try and do this full time and see what happens.
The first book deal we got was so tiny. There were four of us back then. It was my brother, Alex Morris, and Rob Halstead, who we wrote with. We did Framley. There were four of us originally, which meant that you were splitting the money even further.
Yeah.
The workload was better, and it was loads of fun because you were with your mates.
But it was an 11 grand deal, wasn't it, I think?
And it was tiny. I think the year we did the first Framley book, I earned 9 grand, so I win having no money and having to eat tinned fish. But we had it was terrible. And at the end of that year, I remember thinking, what do we do to make money? And I think that was when I went and got an agent to say, look, I've had this Framley Examiner thing, people like it, and people in comedy liked it. Peter Serafinovich was an early fan, Glam Linehan. Nice people in comedy seemed to like it. So I went, I appear to be doing all right. So I went and got an agent, and the agent said, does anyone else from the gang want to get some TV and radio work? And you did, and we'd work together. So we jumped ship together to do comedy in a slightly more professional way and promised them we would not mess about too much.
And of course, you've now written a gazillion shows.
Yeah,
some
none
of which
is ours.
None of which is yours.
It's good,
but
isn't it?
You do have your own. Well, I suppose in terms of the rights, what's the deal with the Penguin books? Because I was going to say, yeah, you've been writers for hire, but you've now got this, which is yours.
Well,
but is it yours?
Yeah, sort of ours. They are ours. Yeah, obviously the artwork's not ours, but all the words are ours. So we've got a share of the ownership of it, and
a good share.
Yeah, and we've got a good share of the success of it as well. But again, but still, it's got the word Ladybird on the front, not the words Joel Morris and Jason Hayes.
It's the first time. I think we'd done something stupid like 14 books, some stupid number of books we've done. This is the first time our names have been anywhere in any of the publicity for it.
Yeah.
So it's quite, because we've done stuff where it had been a big team of us, or we'd done it under a brand, or anonymously, or ghostwritten it. So it's quite exciting to...
Was there an argument about whose name comes first?
It's alphabetical.
No, it's
fine.
Alphabetical. Yeah.
Well, listen, before we talk about your guilty pleasure,
as I said
at the beginning, is...
Yeah. We're getting there.
It's a thing of beauty, I think. We're going to play Jason, your choice. No, Jason, your choice of music. Do you want to introduce this for us?
Yeah, I will. Well, this is from my absolute favourite film score of all time, which is the score to Peter Hyams' film Capricorn One. It's the music by Jerry Goldsmith, and it's got this enormous titanium pair of bollocks, this piece of music. It really has. It's fantastic.
Oh, that was wonderful. How was it you described it?
A titanium pair of balls.
I agree.
What's amazing about that is that that wasn't actually recorded. It was faked.
What?
Just faked on a soundstage.
Really?
Just like Capricorn One.
Wow.
Wasn't a real orchestra.
Oh, there you go.
Just actors.
You go. If you have any other facts like that, please don't call in because this is pre-recorded.
Yeah, why aren't we doing phone calls? I want some phone calls in.
From
this.
Pre-recorded listeners.
Have you not got a phone in your underwater base?
No, we don't. Oh. This is very old school throwback. If you are listening to this as the podcast and are wondering why you're not hearing the songs, well, we only play those when the show goes out 12 p.m. On Fridays. But I'm sure you could listen to the podcast and then just play the song on your computer, couldn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, we live in an age where it's possible to do that.
Yeah.
Jerry Goldsmith, of course, also did Back to the Future, which is one of my favourite scores.
Was that not Alan Silvestri?
Oh, yes, it was. I'm a dick.
Who does a lot of the superhero stuff.
Yes.
Jerry Goldsmith did...
Alien?
What else did he do? Yeah, Alien. Oh, what
Alien.
A great
Planet
score
of the Apes. Oh, there you go. I feel
which
like an idiot now.
We both work to Jerry Goldsmith scores. He puts on Capricorn One, I put on Alien. It makes you scared and you keep working in case something bad happens.
Your work rate goes up. It's amazing.
What happens if you get a little bit of indigestion as well and you're like, oh my god, this is actually happening? So your guilty pleasure, guys. I mean, I don't even know where to begin with this. This is the first show we do cover TV and film and television, but this is the first show where someone's picked a guilty pleasure that's a TV show.
Yeah.
I don't even know if you can call it a TV show. I mean, it's a TV experience.
I would say it's my favourite box set.
Is it a box set?
You can buy it on DVD.
No, you can't.
Yeah, you can.
Can you please explain to people what this show is, it's called? Because I don't even know where to begin.
This show is, continuing the pub theme, this show is basically different corners of a pub put on TV.
It's called The Indoor League, and it was a 70s thing made by Yorkshire TV, and it was, remarkably, the first time darts had ever been shown on television.
Wow.
And it's traditional British pub games introduced by cricketer Fred Truman with a pipe and a dimpled pint jug on the go, and it's amazing. It's sport. Neither of us like sport.
So
and
why do you like this?
Because it's the best sports program ever made. It's just amazing.
They have things like shove halfpenny and
arm wrestling.
Yeah, arm wrestling. I didn't see that in this.
Series 2, there's arm wrestling.
Oh my god,
it was quite a big thing. But when they said Series 2 has got arm wrestling, we got very excited.
I've seen that.
But you can watch it. If you buy a DVD, you can watch it, and it runs.
Does this thing sell? Do people buy this
enough
thing?
For there to be a volume 2? I mean, there was one, and then volume 2 came out thanks to demand. But it's great. It's set in one of those pubs. I mean, I get teary about old pubs because my dad was a darts player and a big fan. So I grew up in pubs that don't look like pubs do now. They had formica tables and red vinyl. They look red vinyl seats like the ones in The Likely Lads in Get Carter. And they built sort of a pub atmosphere in this place in Leeds. And the other thing about it that is brilliant, it is these ordinary people. It is the opposite of pampered sportsmen.
Yeah.
They're bus drivers and headmasters and things, and they're all fat. And the title sequence ends with a man jumping into the air when he gets a bullseye, and his gut pops out of his shirt. And they and they stop and they freeze that as if to say, this is all human achievement. I got a still of that and made it my bus pass holder because it said everything about this big fat man has done something
you
brilliant.
Really are a comedy writer, aren't you? You really are. I mean, there is it was quite a progressive show because I noticed that they were treating women equally as well. There was a female billiards player
really
who
good.
They had the utmost respect for.
We have
a bit of a clip from the show.
Oh, great,
great.
Dive into this.
Now the question is, who's going to take on the Welsh wizard in the final? One thing sure, Valiant there is getting a right clobbering in her final. But it's not putting her off her bashing and walloping style. She's still toting that cue like a cuss.
That, I mean, if people listen to this and now don't want to buy that box set, I don't know.
Well, it was the brainchild of Sid Waddell, you know, the darts commentator who famously had these incredible sort of poetic, he's a classical scholar. He used to write these very, very florid pieces improvise these incredibly florid allusions to Alexander the Great when he was talking about Eric Bristow. So it's got this great thing. He's a very, very clever man who loved ordinary people's games. It was his brainchild, and apparently a friend of ours, who is another writer who's a big fan of pub sports, said this: he hates the indoor league because it popularised darts, and it meant that darts was the one that went on to be the still on television, yeah. And all the other sports got pushed aside. So when you went to a pub, there was only a darts board. There wasn't a skittle alley and a shove halfpenny. It was down to the indoor league that there were. That a lot of those pub games got pushed out in favour of just having a dartboard, yeah, because it took off so big.
I always wanted to write a sketch where you put slice together found footage, as it were, existing footage of a Shakespeare play on stage. And then when you cut to the audience watching it, it's the audience from a darts match.
Go on, love, go on!
We wrote a sketch a bit like that, didn't we? About the two guys sitting in the crowd.
Yeah.
Cheering on the football team and doing it in incredibly long, difficult Shakespearean sentences, and then and obviously then going, "Come on, fucking ref, yeah, you're blind."
It's basically Sid Waddell.
Well, yes. this kind of leads me to one of the questions I had about your TV writing career. Now, you've written on Charlie Brooker's Screen Wipe, yeah, all the wipes.
Yeah, lots of wipes.
Versions of wipes are there?
Weekly Wipe is the one we were doing last. And we do the end of the year review, yeah, which is one of the best fun and toughest things.
How does that work? Do you get given the footage first? Do you have to rifle through
astonishing researchers who have just, basically, it's like the man who fell to Earth. You go to his offices, there's just screens everywhere. People watching him, and they filter it out and they send it.
1984.
Yeah, they send you the bits and bobs of Sky and things, and then it gets boiled down, and you have to sort of keep up with the news and things. But we got a luxury now because we've got Barry Shippies and Philomena Kunk. So if we don't understand a news story, we can give it to them, and they really don't understand it.
Or if it's a really tricky one,
you
can just swing Barry and Philomena in, and they can say all the wrong things because they're allowed to because they're wrong.
The point
about those two is that they're
wrong.
But
you still need to in a degree, know your stuff.
Yeah, you mustn't be ignorant. But it's weird because it ends up being it's ended up oddly being one of the few satire programmes on television.
I know, which is a real sad state of affairs.
And Charlie's so busy, we only get to do 6 or 8 weeks of it a year.
Can I just say I hate Charlie Brooker? Because not only is he so talented, but he makes me feel like the laziest motherfucker in the world. Like, how does he generate so much content?
I don't know. He does work very, very bloody hard.
But he's on a different... He operates on a different plane, doesn't he? Because he does comedy, he does, drama with the...
Should we write it all for him? He doesn't do anything.
It is amazing.
He's all over it, and he's one of those people who House of Tomorrow, which is the company that spun off from Zeppotron and just runs Charlie's things. It is Charlie,
yeah.
And Charlie has his hands over everything. And sometimes you'll deliver. You know, he's really busy, and he's been doing 10 episodes of Black Mirror, and he's knackered. And he'll deliver a script, and he'll go, "Thank God, someone's done the review of the year." And you kind of think he'll just leave it,
yeah,
because he knows we can write in that style. But he never does. It comes back, and he's just absolutely blue penciled it and turned it around and completely done it in his voice. And it's no matter how good you get at writing for him, he'll still rewrite it. He still throws himself completely into it. It's lovely.
That's great. So my last question before we wrap up: you write TV shows, you write books. Which is your favourite? And you played in bands. Mm. What do you love doing the most?
I really like writing. Like it all. I'm very lucky. I get to do things I like for a living.
And it's all writing. Remember you said once when someone said, "What do you do?" in the back of a cab, the easiest thing to say is writer, because that covers music and everything. There's that weird thing, people go, "Stephen Fry, such a polymath," and you go, "He writes and he writes and he writes and he writes."
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, that's the same part of the brain. If he wrote and was an amazing footballer, I'd go, "That's a polymath thing," but it's the same part of your brain.
That would be amazing.
If he was a footballing scientist, I'd get it. But weirdly, when people were saying they really like the Ladybird books because it's very small, short, snappy writing, that's writing a song. It's little lyrics. You get quite good at writing.
Have anything coming up? Anything exciting that we could...
Yeah, there's a thing that part of the BBC Shakespeare season, and possibly the most intelligent part of their Shakespeare
season... It
will be,
definitely.
Philomena Kunk is doing a half-hour special about Shakespeare, which is coming up. I don't know when the date is, because they won't tell us.
It's a secret.
They're trailing it, but they haven't given it a transmission date. Yeah.
That's to make publicising it much, much harder for everybody, so that people will miss it, and then we'll get the blame. But it's we saw the final cut of it, and it's brilliant.
It's very good.
Diane's amazing.
How long is it?
Half an hour.
Brilliant.
So it's Diane talking for half an hour to Shakespeare experts, and she doesn't even understand what plays are. It's brilliant.
She'll be getting a sitcom next. Great. Well, guys, I could have actually talked to you at length on lots of various different things, but sadly
we have in this underwater base. We can always continue. The
well, that's true.
When
did the bomb go off? Has it gone off yet? No. So just to end on another amazing choice of music. When I played this, because I didn't know this based on the title of the track. But when I played it, it immediately gave me a warm, fuzzy feeling. Can you tell us a bit about this last song, John?
This is John Williams.
Yeah. It is. Yeah, yeah.
John Williams. This is from John Williams' soundtrack to Raiders. I got into this again because my son has been playing the Lego video games, mm-hmm. and they've all got the soundtrack, and I'd forgotten this song, and it was an earworm. It's the basket chase in the market, in the bazaar in Raiders. Mm-hmm. And the lovely thing about this is what Spielberg can do is he's really funny,
yeah.
in a way that Lucas isn't.
Well, we don't have to worry about Lucas anymore.
If you grew up with them, you went, they're both great and they both form my childhood. But Spielberg, when he does jokes, they're really funny. And this is a really witty piece of music. And it's a lovely, I mean, it's possibly my favourite film. And I love this because it's an action movie, but it's got space for a proper piece of 1930s knockabout slapstick comedy in it. And this music is perfect for it.
Did you just quickly, did you see that weird thing that, well, not weird, very interesting, fascinating thing that Soderbergh did, where he got Raiders of the Lost Ark, turned it into sort of black and white monochrome and got rid of all the dialogue and music and put like a weird, I can't remember the soundtrack, but he put like a modern dance soundtrack to the, and it was to highlight the expertise of Spielberg's blocking. Yeah. Which is to say, this is how good his blocking is. So if I remove all the things we understand, like we're used to, if you haven't seen it, check it out. It is the most bizarre thing that he has clearly spent a lot of time doing this thing. But it isn't as good as the version that we all know. Thanks, guys. Thanks for coming in. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.